Mark Steiner. You're the Mark Steiner Show and your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Reminding you on our way to this conversation, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. Belongs to you when money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. So we are going to talk a bit about this city paper issue that's now still in the stands until Tuesday at midnight when the new issue comes out that has been looking at the uprising and protests that have taken place in Baltimore. And one of those pieces was written by Nia Hampton, who will be joining us here shortly. She's about to park. She's a writer and filmmaker who wrote an op-alt in the city's paper about watching the uprising from as a Baltimorean in Brazil, but also as a young black woman who grew up in the city and has been deeply involved in this city. Kwame Rose will be joining us. He's a Baltimore-based activist and musician who wrote the op-alt in this week's city paper titled Why I Protest. And in studio with us already is Karen Hubert, who is the new editor-in-chief of the city paper and former assistant professor of multimedia journalism in the School of Global Journalism and Communication here at Morgan State University, and Brandon Soderberger, who is managing editor and art editor of the city paper. One of the articles he wrote in this week's paper was, Can Kevin Davis and the Cops Distinguish a Protest from a Riot? So welcome, good to have you all with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And congratulations again on your becoming editor of the city paper, Karen.
Thank you.
And the number here is 410-319-8888. Join us with your ideas. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Comment on the Mark Steiner Show Facebook page or send us an email to talk@steinershow.org. But do call in as you hear the conversation unfold, 410-319-8888. So, Karen, talk a bit about this issue and why, how it came about and what you wanted to do here.
Well, I think it was just important in the from a journalist perspective to, journalists were very caught up in the moment in terms of covering the protests here this spring and summer. So we thought it might be useful to take a step back now that the dust has settled and to do a sort of postmortem on the protests and rioting and the cops' reaction, et cetera. So it was really a way of, like, delving into the issue, and we invited a pretty diverse group of players to the table. We had some activists weighing in. We had a piece on the cops. We looked at various activist organizations, such as 300 Men March. So we just really wanted to kind of open up the conversation and look back and see what happened and try to make sense of it. And think about ways in terms of this conversation with activists to see how they were going to go forward in the months to come as the Freddie Gray trials happen.
And they're about to start happening November 30th is the first trial, right?
Yep. Yeah.
And Brandon, the piece you wrote was interesting because you wrote about this and Kwame mentioned Commissioner Davis in his piece. Talk about the controversy there as you saw it.
Okay, so I guess the controversy I see it is like Kevin Davis, the interim commissioner who would like to be the commissioner, it seems like the current mayor would like him to be the commissioner as well, has really been cracking down on protests, it seems to me. I feel like it ties to it seems like the Baltimore police are very interested in homicides, which they should be, but they're also very interested in dirt bikes and very interested in protesters right now. That's what they're really cracking down on. And there's been a real clear shift from the spring or even last fall when there were some Ferguson-related protests here to how those were handled under Batts to how Davis seems to be handling them
now. So what's
now.
The difference?
The main difference would be that a lot of the stuff that was tolerated by Batts is not being tolerated. Namely, there seems to be a real thing that you can't walk in the streets anymore. That's been semi-official announcement at this point. Davis has said it a few times. Can't block traffic, can't walk in the streets. And that was never the issue back in during the uprising. And what's really problematic about that, I guess, is that we saw in this protest that Kwame Rose was involved in, as well as Pastor Wesley West, was that Rose...
What was that story? I mean, I'm still unclear. Why was he arrested in his church?
I guess one of the charges, I believe most of the charges have been dropped by now.
Yeah, they were dropped. Yeah, right.
For inciting a riot. which is strange. And I guess that was because he sort
of. I've had that charge in the past myself.
yeah. Although, yeah, and I guess that would be the thing is like that isn't an uncommon charge to lob at protesters, but it's uncommon. It's uncommon in this sort of, you know, since the uprising. You didn't see that a lot during the uprising. And they took him a week later, and they took him the day before the next round of protests was going to happen. And Karen, you kind of wrote about this for the blog as well, about West's the timing of his arrest.
Yeah, it was strange because, you know, they had him on video from aerial surveillance sort of stopping, you know, putting his hands on a car. You look at the surveillance, he's got his hands on the hood of the car and you know, you could interpret it two ways. In some ways, it seemed like he was stopping traffic so the protesters could get across the street. But in any case, if he was threatening or damaging the car in any way, you would think that they would have reacted fairly swiftly in terms of arresting him. But they waited about 6 days, almost exactly. Then they issued the warrant for the arrest. They waited another 24 hours to go to his church and then arrest him on the eve before the second round of protests at the Freddie Gray hearings. So, you know, it was an odd choice that, you know, seems strange given how prevalent the surveillance is in the city right now in terms of the cops watching the protesters and following up on that and security cameras, et cetera.
Well, since they dropped – have they just talked at all about why they actually did that? And since they seem to have dropped the charges, what this was – I mean, because it makes it appear as if this was a matter of control, to control protesters.
Yeah. I don't believe they have responded to that. Yeah. So it's – you know, it's an odd thing. And then, you know, it's I think, you know – part and parcel of the different tactics that are being used now with Davis, and this is something Brandon talks about quite a bit in his piece, you know, really just looking at whether the cops are gearing up for a protest, and most of the protests have been peaceful, or a riot, and whether, you know, what kind of message it sends when they turn out, you know, up in their full riot gear, you know, what does that say to protesters too? So, you know, I think there is a shift. And while the rules existed about protesters not being able to be in the streets under bats, he was a little more cautious about exacerbating the situations, et cetera. And his cops were more likely to kind of ask the protesters to move along, to wait, to urge them, et cetera. Rather than, you know, gearing them up, as I said, in their riot gear and sort of coming out more aggressively, that which, again, doesn't diffuse the situation, I think, and that's a little worrisome.
Right. And so what the pieces that you sought for this piece, I'm curious. I mean, I know this it feels like from what you wrote, this is kind of an ongoing piece that you all want to keep pulling out.
We're definitely going to be on this issue, yes.
And one of the people who wrote one of the articles, Nia, I really found that that piece really interesting and kind of moving as someone who grew up in this community, who has experienced things in this community and was outside this community when it happened in a black community a world away in Salvador, Brazil, when you wrote that piece. Nia, welcome back to the program. Sorry I couldn't be here with you and your mom the other day when you were
okay.
Here.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you back. So talk about where you were, why you were there, and what happened to you at that moment you were watching the uprising in Baltimore from Salvador, Brazil.
Oh, so basically I went to Brazil because I always wanted to go. I was obsessed. I watched a lot of Brazilian movies growing up, and I always wonder, like, where are these people? Why do they look like us but don't speak English? And this isn't Africa, so, like, you know, how does this work? So when I got the chance to go, I went, and I wasn't, you know, trying to be political. I was looking forward to being an observer, being someone not from a place and, you know, observing the politics. And when the riots happened, it was just all very surreal. It was just crazy, really. Like I said, it felt like a movie to watch, to see the images online, to see places that I've frequented a lot, to see them in a different light. Because Mondome was never, you know, a site of police violence to me. Even though growing up, there were always fights, there were always something, but that's kind of just, you know, normal urban life. But this kind of made it really big and really just like, really? It was just really surreal, wasn't anything else.
And I mean, I think there's a lot for us to reflect on when it comes to these kind of what happened during that uprising and what could happen in the coming months. Not necessarily that people are going to go jump in the street, but I'm just saying what could happen in the coming months with the trials coming ahead. Because your piece, I forget whose piece it was that I read in the city paper that talked about, you know, that it might have been your piece, that all of a sudden after these protests are taking place and the CVS is burned down, that you see the mayor talking about reopening rec centers.
And all the things that all the things that led to the violence that you saw at the riots. Because the thing about Mondawmin is, and with the setup with those kids, is that's where all the teenagers in West Baltimore go to school. And a lot of us end up going to school very far away from our homes because those schools are closed down. So they put us in a position where we literally, you know, have no choice. You create these corners for people to live in Baltimore and get upset when we fight back or when we decide that we are over taking what you've been giving us.
You mean because that's like a major transit point?
It is.
Subway, buses,
it is.
Kids and go back and forth.
Exactly.
Way,
and
right?
From what I read on the internet, you know, police were stopping buses, pulling kids off of the bus, like literally setting these kids up to be attacked. And the way it looked on TV, it looked like something that you would see in another country, basically. I never saw police with the plastic shields, you know, and mm-hmm. it's throwing rocks. And it was just very like it came to this because there's always a tension there. But it was surprising that it came to this. And with not necessarily surprising because, you know, I always say Baltimore City East is youth. Teenagers are always the first to be if there is a fund or something involving teenagers. When it comes to budget cuts, it's always us. Well, us. Them. I'm no longer a teenager. So
I mean, one of the things that strikes me that's going on here, there's a big debate in this community, has to do with the murder rate in Baltimore. And people kind of blaming it on the uprising, that's why that there's this uptick in...
I think it's just a lot more media attention on Baltimore. I think there are a lot of things going on with, you know, the... I think police went on strike or something after the riots, and
well, they didn't go on strike, but they did their own form of working strike, which was to not, as someone said to me in Gilmore Homes, that you know people are packing guns and now the guns aren't hidden behind their coats, people are wearing them out, visible for everybody to see as you walk across the street because police are not stopping anybody doing anything because they're saying if we stop somebody we're gonna go to jail.
Yeah,
so that was their. Yeah. Work, slow down.
And Commissioner Batts, once he wasn't commissioner anymore, sort of semi-confirmed that. He said, you know, that the police took a knee. You know, so that was quasi-confirmed.
I just think in America in total, people really don't understand how police work and how it's a flawed system. You know, I've lived in Ecuador, and for maybe 2 weeks I was visiting a majority black community in Esmeraldas. We lived like across the street from a newly built police station. Same amount of crime. Nothing changed. Like there's like it's the police and then it's crime around the police. And it's not like the presence of police deters the crime, you know? So that's what I never understood.
That's an interesting point you raise here. And an interesting point to explore vis-a-vis the uprising and where we may go from here in this community. Kwame Rose has joined us. Welcome, Kwame. Is that no matter where you go in the world, and you talked about this a little bit in your piece, Nia, that because of the dislocation of black communities, especially poor black communities, and the over-policing of poor black communities, and the over-incarceration of black people for any kind of crime that might take place, violent or nonviolent, mm-hmm. or no crime at all. that's something to explore. I mean, in terms of when you talk about what it is that we have to do to deal with changing the way police, it's deeper than, I think, changing the way police, if you're even going to get to the point of how police, if that makes any sense whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. No, clarify.
You know, I mean, I think that's part of it. I mean, it's not just about reforming the police. It's about an entire system that has been created over centuries that especially young black inner city kids and young people and adults are facing in neighborhoods, not just in Baltimore. I mean, the murder rate and anything else is not just Baltimore. It's Chicago. It's L.A. It's New Orleans. It's everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just a Baltimore phenomenon. So that's something I think that might be kind of an interesting thing to explore and wrestle with. Kwame, you can have at it first since you walking in. Welcome with your O's hat.
No, thank you all.
Did they win last night? I don't even know, but go ahead.
I don't even like the Oreos
okay,
anymore.
Okay, just like the hat.
I just need a haircut. So now I think in particular in Baltimore, right, when you talk about the murder rate, so we saw an influx of, crime in Baltimore is nothing new. What happened ever since the Freddie Gray protest in May when things kind of died down was that we saw the police response to crime kind of stop. So literally the police were like, you know, if we can't abuse you all, if we can't use excessive force, then we just won't do our job at all. So here you got like 400 people who have been arrested for protesting since April, but yet the homicide clearance rate is like 30%. So it's just like, you know, what is policing? And that's why someone like Michael Wood, who's the former Baltimore City cop that started tweeting. That's why he's so important, right? Because he's literally the prime example of everything that's wrong with policing in urban cities. He's white. He's from he lives in York, Pennsylvania. He commutes here. And literally, he'll admit that it's just a thrill. It was a thrill. And so but he's done everything to kind of combat that now. And so what has to happen is like, look, I don't ever want to be a cop. You will never see me shake a hand with a cop now. Well, I'll shake hands with a black cop. But you'll never see me, like, encouraging anybody to be a Baltimore City police officer because the system has to change. And what we've seen from the City Hall and even Davis, like, they don't want to change. And Davis is making it clear that he's, like, going to be more aggressive.
So I just leap in. I want to hear our listeners what they think about this. 410-319-8888. Please join us for your thoughts. I mean, as we're looking at this issue and I'm reading all the articles, I think there's a number of the great articles in this particular issue by a lot of different people. We could have had 2 hours with just the people who are just wrote the pieces to talk about their different perspectives on what they see. But what are your thoughts at 410-319-8888? Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. I mean, is it more in your sense, in your minds about reforming police, or how do we get to something that's even deeper here? And I mean, how do you even begin to think about reporting that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's one of the things that, you know, when you raise these questions is it's very clear suddenly how interconnected all of these issues are. And if you look at how much of the violence is drug related or how many of the gangs are drug related, and, you know, then there's a question, what would happen if drugs were legalized here? What would happen if weed was legal? What would happen to the trade if it was no longer run by gangs or whatever? Then the police might have a shift in focus, and they might actually be able to do things differently, not be running around arresting people for possession or petty crimes related to possession. You know, there's so many different things I think that are connected here and that need to happen before real police reform can take place. And I mean, Kwame, I was interested in what you were saying when you were saying you wouldn't encourage any young black men or women to be a cop. You know, it's interesting to think how do we reform the system? What has to happen, do you think? You don't think it can happen from within, it sounds like? Or?
Well, for one, like before that, I answer that one, I want to touch on one point, right? So even if we go off of the theory that because everyone broke into the CVS and these pharmacies and now they're selling drugs and that's increasing violence on the street, mm-hmm. like these drugs were going to be sold legally by white corporations in Baltimore City. So this theory that these drugs are like causing all this violence.
No,
I'm talking about so Baltimore City's perspective, like the police's perspective.
Oh, okay.
So I think what has to happen, right, is that there has to be what never happens when we talk about change, what continues to not happen even now after Freddie Gray, is that we never engage the people who are going to be affected by the system. So they make all these, and I find it today, like I speak on these panels where I'm kind of outcasted because I'm not like in a suit. I don't have these degrees and everything. But literally, I look just like and hang out with the people who are going to be the targets, who may be the next Freddie Gray. But we never talked to those people. And that's what was so beautiful about the Baltimore uprisings was literally it wasn't no organization. It wasn't any like people who knew how to protest. It was literally like we was walking down the street because we saw people we knew and we felt the same pain because we all been victims of the violence of Freddie Gray. So we have to start like Stephanie hasn't done it, has not done a good job of it.
Come on, the mayor.
Yep. She's the Well, sure if she we, should, yeah. if that's what you classify her. But no, so she doesn't, well, she won't engage anyway. With protesters. They're literally at the public safety forums. They literally will put bodyguards on people who have been identified as protesters, won't let you ask a question. Davis, the same thing. And Davis will only come out like the week after they arrested me. He came out to the protest and like, hey, Kwame, shake my hand with all these cameras around. But nah, bro, like. We literally been trying to reach out to you without cameras to have a real conversation about how do we productively change the system and encourage people to become Baltimore City police officers.
So again, I guess a lot of people have said that part of the problem is that there are not enough black police officers in Baltimore, not enough officers who live in the city, be they black, white, Latino, or Asian, who live in Baltimore and relate to the city itself, the people live outside the city. That may be a factor. But I think, what I was pausing earlier before we opened the phones here is that maybe the issues we're facing here, you talked about white supremacy in your piece that you wrote, Kwame, and I think that and that's clearly a major component I think of what we're facing here in this country. But the issues are a great deal deeper, you know. And I was saying before we saw the program, we had a program last week, and one of our guests, who was from the East Side, a young man, 26 years old. Kept referring to what it's like to walk outside your home every day and the house next door is a vake. And every other house is that. And it's deeper than just policing. Policing is a huge piece of it because that is not about – apparently not about solving crimes because crimes aren't getting solved. Mm-hmm. About having a kind of police force that lives closer inside the community so it can solve the crimes that do exist. But it's about what's fueling this from the bottom up that affects the police and everybody else.
Which, I think that's the history of the country and the culture that we live in, though. Like, it's something that won't be solved with police work because policing is just a Band-Aid for what we are living in. You know, Baltimore is just a small version of what we as a whole country face, and I think it takes a lot. It takes not to bring out the big reparations word, but, like, you know, it...
The R word.
You know, like, it's a lot. It is a lot that's going to go into it. And I think the focus on the police work is a distraction, more or less.
I think that what had to happen was that we had to have an uprising, right? Because, like, the people of Baltimore, if you're from Baltimore, you know, like, there's not a lot that brought people together. And what you saw through the uprisings was kind of this communalism from east, west. Like, literally everybody came out to the street and was one in protecting each other from the police. But what it also did, for myself included, right, was, like, growing up, you know, you knew that there were vacant homes all up and down Baltimore City. But you just grew accustomed to it and started expecting it as a way of – as that's what's normal life and that's what you should expect growing up in Baltimore City. So what happened with the uprisings is that you got so many people now – that are talking about how do we change, and so many people who are gathered in different, you know, different retrospects. So now you have people creating food networks for children who only eat at school, because then we saw kids really don't have food unless they go to school. So now we create these food networks and feed them in their neighborhoods instead of just only giving them food. You have people who are you have people like Jamal Bryant who now are like opening up youth centers and trying to break ground on a job training center. You know, people who actually are getting into the community now and trying to change things for the better.
We got a very quick break. We're going to go right to the phones to Gary when we come back as we look at the – as we take kind of dissecting the recent issue of the city paper, focusing on the protests in Baltimore with two of the authors and two of the folks who make that paper hum. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Gary and Dolores are the first two callers up. We'll take your calls as soon as we return. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're here talking about the Baltimore City Paper's issue that's out this week. The new one comes out Wednesday, but what came out last week on Wednesday, which was the protest issue, which we talked about a little bit on our show Wednesday. We're here with Karen Hoopert, who is the editor-in-chief of the Baltimore City Paper, Brandon Soderberg, who is a managing editor and arts editor, wrote the piece on Kevin Davis and the cops near Hampton, as a writer and filmmaker who wrote the op-alt in the city paper about her experiences watching the Baltimore uprising as a Baltimorean in Brazil. Kwame Rose is a Baltimore-based activist and musician who wrote the op-alt in the city paper entitled Why I Protest, and you at 410-319-8888. Gary, welcome. You're on the air.
Thank you, Mark, and thanks to all you guys there in the studio. Man, I totally feel you, brother, on that situation with the police. I have a lot of friends who are police. I'm a member of the public safety team. I work with the fire department. And when Kevin Davis got that acting commissioner position, I was privileged to read the piece in the city paper. I just had to peruse it because I'm one of those people that's voracious in reading, probably reading 100 books. I simply pulled out my note page from Kevin Davis in that article that I reread a short time ago. He was accused of roughing up then 19-year-old Brian Rumju, it was 16 years ago when Davis was with PG, he was with the Prince George's Police Department.
Right.
Took him to a remote location with other officers to terrorize him in an attempt to get info regarding his girlfriend, a niece of a high-ranking PG police commander. Rumju was awarded $90,000 in a court of law. Davis and others violated the civil rights, excessive force. The incident began on 9/4/99. Davis was a sergeant then. This was a federal civil rights trial in 2002 of June. PG cops were out of their jurisdiction when they essentially kidnapped Rumju. This ordeal lasted for 5 hours. Davis slammed his head against the window 3 to 5 times. In 1993, Davis threw a young man to the ground and handcuffed him without explanation. The young man was awarded $12,500 from a jury against Davis.
Okay.
In 2013, Davis became an Anne Arundel County police chief. He joined the BPD in January of this year.
Correct.
Just want to know, before I let the other callers come in, what time is this meeting at Carver?
What time is the meeting at Carver?
Yeah, tonight, because the mayor and Davis are supposed to be at Carver tonight.
Our producers will find out. I don't know about that. I haven't heard about that. I'm sorry.
Right, but I feel you. I don't wave to the police anymore unless I know them.
Got you. Gary Nelson, I know he's a firefighter and an active community participant. So you were shaking your head during this conversation, Brandon. What do you know about what he was talking about?
City Paper did report on that when he became commissioner. I mean, we're not the first people to report on it, but we kind of tried to remind people of that. And I guess I was shaking my head, too, because I found, when Davis came in, tried to be a reporter and I saw him shaking hands, introduced myself to him a few times. And he seemed to be very interested in engaging people in a different way than Batts had been doing, at least during the uprising, whereas Batts had been out during the Ferguson protest here. Batts was not out during the uprising. Whereas Davis showed up, there was a protest on August 8th for the anniversary of Michael Brown's death. And Davis showed up for a few minutes. I know that's like a small thing, but I was like, that's good for him, But it ties to what we were talking about before, which is I think it's a lot of it seems to be about optics. And I think that's one of the concerns. That's what I've concerned about Davis.
Has he ever responded to what happened in Prince George's County? Has he ever talked about what he did, why he did it, or what happened?
Not that I know of. I'm sorry.
I will say, like a month before Batts was fired, like I know personally, like Batts reached out to me. Like personally, and had a meeting in which he literally was like, listen, I need whatever help I can get because the cops hate me and it seems like the protesters hate me. And only I told him, like, I couldn't help you unless you come out and literally say, like, these officers killed Freddie Gray and they need to be punished.
But he couldn't do that, though.
Yeah, you can do it. Like, if you care about the liberation of people, you should risk everything you have.
But the reality is in certain positions, people are not going to say that until there's a trial.
I don't believe in that.
Okay, well, but I think that I understand people saying that we have to come out stronger. But I don't expect people in those kind of power positions to come out and say that stuff. They're just not going to do it. I mean, and
But I do think that, like, that Bats was out during Ferguson was really important. And then when it was his guys, he couldn't come out. I think that because just the presence of the police commissioner during a protest would be an affront to certain people. Or, again, it's that optics. That
right.
So I get it. He's not gonna come out and say.
But I also
understand
what you're saying, Kwame. From a political perspective, I understand what you're saying as well.
Like Russell, like so, if you go through Baltimore, like Melvin Russell,
yep.
is the prime example of someone. Like he's the prime example of someone who's grown up in Baltimore City, became a police officer, has been in the community, and there is like literally no reason why Melvin Russell shouldn't be the police commissioner.
Or something like Melvin Russell, yeah.
Right. Literally, he's been a police officer for 40 years and is the most respected police officer throughout all of Baltimore. So why wouldn't you make him the police commissioner?
Now, I've watched these protests when they've taken place that Melvin Russell has walked in the middle, talked to people, been out there in uniform.
And if you notice, they only arrest people when he's not there.
I have not noticed that, but I'll take your word for it this moment. I've not noticed that, but it could be very true. Yeah. Let's go back to the phones of 410-319-8888. And tonight, my producer just looked up, Mayor Seth Rollins Blake and Police Commissioner Kevin Davis will hold a public safety forum in the Western District, 7 p.m. at Carver Vocational High School, 2201 Pressman Street. Pressman Street. So it's tonight, 7 p.m. at Carver, the mayor and Davis at 7 p.m. at Carver Votech. That's where it'll be. Place where I used to teach, 410-319-8888, many years ago. Dolores, you're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, you asked a question, Mark, whether or not police presence deter crime, and I think not. I think that a certain amount of crime is permitted. And I look at that as being what they would call a twofer, two for one.
Mm-hmm.
One man is dead, and another person is locked up. And that is just such a perpetuating way of how this whole system has worked for so many years. I think of young men coming out of prison, how they come into the community, their anger is really manifested right in the community that they live in. You know, they've been hurt by a system, but they come out and they display that anger to the people who are closest to them, family, friends, over stupid kinds of situations that are so easily resolved, but they don't have the skills to do it. Thank you very much.
Dolores, let me pick up what you just said. And I think that that's a series of programs that I'm really looking to produce with my producers here, which has to do with the psychological effects of racist and economic trauma on poor communities mm-hmm. in this country and how it affects how people respond and behave. And what you're saying, I think we can reflect on this for a moment, is really is really true that when I was – Ta-Nehisi Coates in his last piece he wrote in The Atlantic, one of the things he referred to a book by this guy David Oshinsky. He said, Worse Than Slavery, the Parchment Farm, the Ordeal of Jim Crow. When he wrote about what happened between 1900 and 1930 with black folks in Mississippi, that 67% of the killers in Mississippi and 80% of the victims were black. And you add to that the lynchings and the racial oppression took place, and it's the inward, it's kind of the what happens in the community when people are just completely isolated from the rest of the world, and the police don't care to police that violence, they let that go because that violence they don't care about that violence, and I think that, I mean, that's what I'm saying when I think there's something deeper afoot here that we have to figure out in terms of what it is we want to build in this city of Baltimore and in America if we're actually serious about changing it. And it's beyond just having police wear cameras on their chests.
I think it just says a lot about the way we deal with violence when it comes from a white man and from a black man or from,
yeah.
you know, because if you think about the massacres and the recent school shootings, these are, for the most part, they look a certain type of way, you know. And these people get to go out and live a quote-unquote normal life, and they get to have this big excuse, and they get to have the idea of mental illness to kind of shield to shield them, when in reality, that's the culture they come out of, you know? I think in my experience, most of the violence that I've seen in Baltimore City is logical. It's about money. It's about survival, you know? I've never seen a person do anything when it comes to killing people. It's never been out of sheer spite. It's about, you owe me this. You are interrupting this. It's a business move, you know, to
for
a certain extent, you know?
Is.
So it's never out of this, you know, it's different than how it's portrayed when it comes from white men.
But let me ask a question, because I'm really curious how, also from your perspective, after I ask this question, how the media wrestles with this and how we look at this in the media. But I think that's true. I mean, a guy whose name I won't mention, because I don't have permission to use his name yet, but I'm going to get him on the show soon, who was deep in the drug trade and now is out of the drug trade and works three jobs to keep himself out of the drug trades, said, you know, he just came back from another funeral of a cousin and said almost everybody killed that he knows in the streets has been killed because they're part of their trade. Not like somebody just walk up to him, I'm going to kill you, boom, shoot mm-hmm. you like your shoes, which is part of the mythology, but it's part of the trade.
And we're right? treated that way too. We're treated as if the way, you know, that we go about our violence as a black community is pathological, when in reality it's a fact of circumstance. You know, it's we don't have anything. Our communities don't necessarily have other resources. This is how it's been for a long time. So it makes sense, in my opinion.
Right. And so I think that again continues to beg the question of what we do, A, in the process of changing that, to heal young people and people in
more
general.
Resources. More
right.
resources so that we don't have to go to, you know, these alternative means to provide for ourselves.
We're going
to
say Kwame, then I'm going to turn it over to our journalist here for a moment. Kwame?
So I look at it like, if you ask anybody that's in the game, right, there's one rule. You don't never affect nobody who's not. And so it's a business. And so I can't mention his name, but I kind of look at him like a mentor, right? He several college degrees, literally, and he's in the game, and he uses it's a business, and he won't. And the reason is because being a black man from Baltimore City with all these degrees, still you still don't have access, right, to do business on a quote unquote legal scale, and or what's accepted, right? And so you have to apply that some way to make a means for yourself, because don't nobody want to catch the bus to work and work three jobs. Like J. Cole said, I'm not hopping out the shower to make $10 an hour. That's just not what anybody wants to do for themselves. So if there's not a way that you can get it by, if the American dream is not obtainable by working a 9-to-5, then you should be able to chase that dream any way that you can.
Well, let me ask you this question. As a group here, but then as I've been thinking of this a lot, as I read the entire issue again early this morning, I was thinking about this, and that the 9-year-old little girl was part of the crossfire. Mm-hmm. Not probably, she was shot by a guy who was shooting four of the guys, but not a literal crossfire. But she was shot in the leg. But the other part of that is there's the trauma, as someone wrote about, of what it's like to walk out of your house every day knowing that someone you pass on the corner is packing something serious. Mm-hmm. That kind of psychological fear that people live under as well.
But it ain't no fear because, you know, the NRA does it, right?
Yeah.
You let all these white men carry guns and it ain't no problem. And they the ones
I'm not
that
talking
do
about
mass
the crime
shoots.
Part of it. I'm just talking about this.
The fear.
The psychology.
We fear black people with weapons. Like, so the only problem is that
we fear black people without weapons.
Well, no, I'm saying so society.
Black people
I'm talking
in
about
suits.
Society
like, we fear black
in general.
Skin in
right?
general. So
right,
the idea
right,
that
right,
packing
right,
a gun
right.
is not necessarily. I'm not. When I me personally, I'm getting over it myself because it's internalized as well. But, you know, I don't think it's the gun that's making people afraid of black people, or
that.
You know,
right? No. That's holding up. I agree.
But are like people are like a bunch of fools in Arkansas that carry open carry and stuff like that? Are those like we don't? I don't think there's an assertion that those people are traumatized by it. Are they?
I think the trauma is coming from a lot of different things, and it's not
right.
necessarily
just that.
You
right.
know,
exactly.
It's years and decades, and just it's heavy. But honestly, I will say I think the riots were for white people. I think the riots were for people who weren't necessarily in the community who didn't know. Because from what I've seen, we know what's been going on. You know, and if you've been doing community activism, this is, you know, everyday stuff. But I've been more amazed at the reaction that I get from, you know, white people. It's like, wow, I didn't know. And it's kind of weird because growing up in Baltimore City, it's like, how could you not know? But then you remember, oh, your reality doesn't look like this.
Right.
You know, you don't have these problems. So a lot of these things that we have to go through, a lot of this explaining, a lot of this, you know, asserting my humanity every day and every conversation and every, you know, that gets triggering. And that's traumatized for me personally more than the idea
people
that somebody's walking down the street packing a gun. The idea that I got to go to a job interview and really not just prove that I'm worthy of this job, but that I'm also a person, that I'm not going to rob you, that I'm not angry. You know, all of those things, those microaggressions add up every day.
Absolutely.
I think it also, like, the uprisings, and I don't necessarily look at, like, white people's reaction or their acceptance of the uprisings. Because for me, like, the uprisings taught, like, a lot of, like, so Cornel West said this in Chicago in, like, June, I think, at the Justice Conference. He said, he was talking to an all-white audience, and he was like, I see a lot of white supremacy in myself, so I know y'all got a lot of work to do. And I think what the uprising showed us, right, was, like, when people was out there burning cars so the police couldn't get down North Avenue, it showed us, like, yo, we really have to have each other's back. And that's, like, the sense that you get now from, like, walking in a community. Like, when I walk, so I, like, up until, like, 3 weeks ago, I lived right by Baltimore and Carey Street, one of the most dangerous blocks in the city. And literally, it's nothing but love. Like, all the people you would think that are labeled as thugs and criminals, it's nothing but acceptance. And what you need, anything you need, all right, just, and if anything happens, all right, I need you to walk off. And that's so much love and so much respect that I think would not have happened if we didn't have the uprisings.
That is true. I agree.
That's
with
a really
that.
Important point. So, go ahead, Karen.
I was just going to ask Kwame. So, what do you think the next step is?
We got to fund all these thinkers, right? What the uprisings did was like we saw like so much talent inside of Baltimore. So we saw like Devin Allen and his amazing pictures. So we have to continue to fund, because just like there's thousands of Freddie Grays in this city, there's thousands of Devin Allens, there's thousands of Nia's, there's thousands of Malaika Gilliam Price that go to city. So we have to start not only highlighting this black youth, but also doing whatever we can to make sure they have the network and the resources to achieve anything that they want to do.
Mm-hmm. Resources and opportunities.
It's
always been that.
So I'm going to go back to the phones here, but I want to kind of ask first Karen and Brandon. So that when we think about how to look at the uprising, and I'm pointing to our other guests because they are the uprising, and need to be, and we all need to be, but then how do you begin to think about reporting on something that gets under these things and pulls that out? The kind of things we're talking about here. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things, sort of most obvious is to stay on the story instead of to act like this is some aberrant thing that happened here in Baltimore, and to really contextualize it and realize, as Kwame has said, this is these issues, or maybe Nia, you mentioned this too. This is not – these issues have been around for a long time, and – they are pretty well understood, I think, in the black community and talked about and taken as a given. That's not necessarily true in the white community. And I think, City Paper in the days ahead is definitely going to stay on this, keep talking to activists, keep trying to see the connections between these protests and dig into some of the other issues that are problematic here in Baltimore, looking at the employment rate, staying on the story of the cops, looking at public housing, job opportunity, and racism and segregation that exists in our schools here in Baltimore. And we're going to be writing about that in the days ahead, too. So, again, really looking at Baltimore City and not trying to downplay the many, many problems that this city has that it needs to address and that we need to take seriously.
Can I offer a suggestion?
But. Sure.
It's easier to do that as well if you employ more people of color, more people in the community as well. So I think, we gotta be real realistic, in regards to who, like you said, funding, resources, opportunity, if it's really going to be a new Baltimore like it seems people want.
Yeah, and I would challenge all the rest of the media, local media especially, to be more like the City Paper, right? To be more inclusive of not just one voice. So we get a lot of times, and D. Watkins is so incredible about this.
He's a good man.
He shares the wealth, I wouldn't have had the opportunity to write for City Paper if it wasn't for D. Watkins. you know, saying y'all need to expand and push the envelope. So I would challenge, like, and the city paper is just one entity in Baltimore, but there's so many other. So I would challenge the Sun to, you know, to start writing more heavily about the protest and let, you know, expand the narrative so that it's more transparent and not one-sided.
And actually, you know, hire people, not just have it be, you know, build that wealth, build that so that they can be a pipeline into the city paper so that it becomes a place where young people of color feel like, you know, I can walk in and be a part of something and not just used for a moment, you know? Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah.
All good suggestions, I think, you know. And I think one of the things, too, that's important to remember in the media, and, of course, Mark Steiner, you do this all the time very well, but is to let those conflicting views sit there, to collect them, because instead of trying to resolve them into something tidy when it's not tidy. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of different ideas, and some of them are in conflict, and people don't agree. And to let that debate take place in a lively, productive way in the pages of the paper, or as you often do on your show, Mark.
And I think that that's important. I mean, I think journals like the City Paper, news journals like the City Paper, I think are important because they reach this broad audience of white people in the city more than black people. And that, to open this up, that's part of what has to happen, mm-hmm. you know, and because it's almost, it's not like an underground paper, the late 60s, early 70s, but it has that feel, so people look at it in a different way than they do like reading the Sun.
Mm-hmm. And I'd also I'd also say, like, we need, like, more white comrades or quote-unquote allies. Like, we need them to, like, speak up, because there seems to be, like, this phenomenon where we only, like, acknowledge black problems and accept them and try to do anything about them when white bodies are talking about them. So, like, even if you look at, like, the situation with talking about Baltimore City policing, right? Michael Wood is a white cop, but what's his name? Joey Crystal has been talking about all the experiences he had.
Who's Joey Crystal? I'm sorry, man.
Joe Crystal, the black cop. He was the one that got fired for talking about it, right? But he's this black cop who has been talking about it way before anybody else, and no one listened.
Yeah. See, well, I just said who's Joe Crystal, right?
People tend to listen to who they look like and who they relate to. Like, men tend to listen more to men, and, you know.
So. I think, like, we all, like, you know, when black people, so it's this phenomenon, like, when black people talk, it's just, well, he's just whining, right? Yeah. But when white people talk about it, it's more of an acknowledgement. Like, no, this has really happened. We need that. We need white approval for it to be realistic.
So let's go back to the phone. Anybody wants to leap in here? Let's get some thoughts before we close out the hour. 4103. Any thoughts?
Yeah. I want to throw in. Yeah, I mean, the biggest what I see is the problem with the city that the uprising made really clear, which the paper is also doing in this issue, even as we use black voices, is there's still this, like, this, people say it's an apartheid city, and I used to be skeptical of agreeing with that. I knew it was segregated, but it is an apartheid city. There are certain spaces that black people aren't allowed to be in, and that's, I think, what so much of it has to do with. And that's what so much of the piece I wrote, at least, was about, is how it really is about downtown. Mm-hmm. It's about the rage that whites feel when black people go downtown, not to be tourists, as if that space is a white space.
Right.
And this issue kind of represents that a little bit. It's really great. You know, we can pat ourselves on the back all we want about how, like, you know, I think other than myself, there's all African-American writers in that. And that's cool and all. But the next issue of the paper probably doesn't look like that. We got to figure out how to fix that.
And just to, like, attest to that, so I used to work in Harbor East. And, like, they literally design their menus, their programs, their discounts so that locals don't come. So if you look at the jazz brunch that used to be popular down in Harbor East at one of the hotels, literally they took the jazz brunch out because there were too many quote-unquote locals who are spending the same amount of money.
Who would that be?
What, the locals? Black people. Like the people two blocks away who they took the land from to build these, you know, tourist areas. And they literally say it's too many locals because they don't want a certain type of people inside of their spaces.
And I think all that has to be kind of confronted on every level that happens. Mm-hmm. I think the school debate we're about to have around charter schools in the city and the state is part of that debate. Not that I'm necessarily against charter schools, but if you institute them like they do in other states, then you end up building this two-tiered public system where a majority of black children will be left out, mm-hmm. once again. I mean, so there's a lot of things that
I'm a product of a charter school, though. I think they can work. It really depends.
I'm not saying they're bad. I think charter schools are good. I'm saying that, we can't get that out. But I mean,
I know. But I'm interested in that discussion.
Well, come to the next one we're going to have. We're going to have that soon. Because we need to push that idea.
They can be really awesome, but it really takes a certain type of work in a community. And
every school in Baltimore should be a charter school.
Yeah.
And run like a charter school.
Essentially, it's a community school.
Not just for
school.
A few, you know what I'm saying? Right?
Yeah. That's basically what it is. Like, yeah.
Right. I mean, that's part of the issue with that. And I think those are the kind of things I think that are really, since Baltimore's kind of a ground zero in some ways, Karen, for America, because of what just happened. We have this opportunity to create conversations and look for solutions and fight for answers in ways other communities don't. And maybe people will pay attention to what we're saying because of where we're coming from.
Let's hope.
You know, I mean, I think that's true. I think that we've put ourselves on the map in a different way, I think, Kwame, than we ever have had in my history here as a national symbol.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think that's what's so key about Baltimore. It's a major American city. It's run by black. It's majority black. The majority of the population is about 63% black. All the elected officials, besides like two city councilmen, are black. But it's still like really run by white supremacy. And it's still you still see on a national forefront now that like poor black people are disengaged from the system.
And I think one of the things that about the protest too that makes me feel really hopeful about it is that there were so many young people, so many of my Morgan students and so many of my son and his high school friends that were out protesting and felt so excited and empowered to be doing something. And it was a real shift from the usual jaded, like,
yep.
I don't care about politics. I can't do anything anyway. All politicians are corrupt. I give up. I'm disengaging. This was completely different, and I think that was a really, really hopeful, exciting thing.
Well, I want to thank all of you. Karen Hubert, you just heard, new editor-in-chief of the City Paper. Brandon Soderberg, who's managing editor and arts editor, wrote one of the pieces this week. Nia Hampton and Kwame Rose, two activists in this community. Nia's also a writer and filmmaker, and they both wrote really good pieces in the City Paper. We'll be linking to them all. You can also get them in the City Paper. Thank the four of you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hampton, Kwame Rose, Brandon Soderberg, and Karen Hooper. Good to have you all here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andrea Melton. Our interns are Sienna Greaves, Manifa Wilson, and Calvin Perry. Theme music by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's show to talk@steinershow.org. Podcast The Mark Steiner Show. Share it with your friends. Visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.